Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is writer and director Alan Broca, perhaps best known for the Rick and Steve series, Boy Culture, the Eating Out movies, and Before I Got Famous. Well, welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and it's a great pleasure to have you here. As you know, my project is all about documenting stories and histories of the gay bars that have come and gone over the years. And for quite a few years, you have made an impact in recording gay history as well through your movies and different aspects, and it kind of encapsulating gay life. So I'm really excited to have you kind of tell us a little bit about your background. Now you told me that your very first experience at a gay bar night was at a club in Seattle called the Oz.
Correct. Yeah. So it was this 18 and up club that it wasn't like fully an official gay club, but they had like two, I think they were just open on weekends, and they had two nights. One was like a hip hop night and one was like pop night. And the pop night was like half gay. There was like a half of the dance floor was where the gay kids hung out and the other half was not gay kids. So that was kind of the first time I saw like a gay scene of any type. And this was back in the 80s and 90s in Seattle.
Now, so this was kind of an alternative environment. Based on what I know about a lot of the clubs like that, they probably didn't serve alcohol, right? It was more of an after hours type where they serve juice or soda or whatever. And is that right?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't even know what they served. I don't think they had alcohol. Like, I don't think I even ever ordered a water there. Like there was a cover and then we would just go in and dance. But yeah, I don't think there were many people, if any, who were over 21. I didn't go after I turned 21 because then you felt like a dinosaur there. It was like totally for like high schoolers and early college.
And it was it actually like a proper club or was it more like a warehouse space with a dance floor and music?
It was a proper club. It was, I don't know what they did the rest of the week, but it was called the Oz. It had a different name before it was called the Oz, but it had the same nights. I don't remember what that name was, but I remember that at the time, people who knew it by that name were considered old, even though it was only like a year or two before. But it just was a different era, I guess, from when it began.
And then you mentioned, I guess, a couple years later, you experienced another gay nightclub in Seattle called Neighbors, which apparently has a very long history. And from what I can tell, it appears to still be in business.
Yes, it is. So, I mean, as far as I know, Neighbors is still there. It was there last time I went up, but it was my first official fully gay club that I went to. I went there at the age of 19 with a fake ID to get in. And then I went there quite a bit until they took my fake ID away. And then I had to wait till I was 21. So I went there quite a bit at 19 and then at 20. I lost my ID and couldn't go back until I was 21.
So how did that compare to the Oz type bar? Was it, you know, a better environment? Was it more, did it feel more like a gay bar to you? What was the difference between the two experiences?
The Oz felt kind of like a high school dance where there was just a whole bunch of gay kids. But Neighbors felt like a full-on gay bar nightclub cruising. Like, I don't think I ever met anyone at the Oz and had a one-night stand. Like, I never had that vibe. I met people and went on dates. Kind of, it was very high school feeling. neighbors, people were cruising like all the time. So it was different in that aspect. And then, you know, the age range, you know, neighbors was 21 to no upper limit. So there was like generations of people there. The Oz was really, it was rare that there was anyone over 21 at that club.
Did these experiences kind of solidify the fact that you were gay, or did you already pretty much know that well before you ever went into one of those bars?
Oh, I committed long before I went into a club. So I was super gay and super out and belonged to organizations, but it was weird to be part of this community that was so heavily based in nightclubs, but you could not participate in that function, in that part of it. And there were a bunch of us in Seattle, like 18, 19, 20. I was in college and, you know, it was the early 90s. It was still, everything was still pretty homophobic. So there weren't many gay spaces at all. And we would kind of dream about the day we could turn 21 and go to bars and meet people and have this space. Because other than that, the only other place to meet, you know, people was like on a street or in cruising spots.
Right.
There just wasn't an opportunity to connect with other LGBTQ people.
And what time frame was this?
The early 90s. So I turned 21 in 1993.
Okay. So not that long ago. I mean, we're talking about, well, now it's 30 years, I guess.
But, yeah, it's quite a long time ago.
I came out in, first gay bar experience was in 1978. Mm-hmm. So, but it still doesn't seem like it's been that long.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine. And I know for me, when I first came out, when I first came out to a gay bar, I knew I was gay. I had a boyfriend in high school. Mm-hmm. We were really close. We went off to college in separate directions. So we were like 8 hours apart when we mm-hmm. were in college, but I would still occasionally make a train trip and take the Amtrak down the East Coast. He was in Baltimore. I was in Boston. And he took me to a bar in Baltimore that I didn't know was a gay bar. We had gone to have dinner downtown. And he said, oh, there's this club my roommate showed me right up the street. Why don't we go there? And we went in there and ordered a drink. And I was standing there sipping on my drink, looking over the dance floor. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, I realized everybody on the dance floor was male. Mm. And I was like, oh, wow, this is kind of cool. And from then on, I was kind of submerged in the gay bar scene. And it was quite an experience, because I know what you mean. At that time, whether it was the late 70s or the early 90s, that whole bracket of time, that was the only part of gay socializing, really, was the club scene. Mm-hmm. There weren't really gay sports leagues everywhere like there are now. There weren't youth centers, you know, gay youth centers in the cities and stuff. So pretty much everybody, whether it was going to be a friend or a business acquaintance or a boyfriend or a trick or whatever it was going to be, it all seemed to come out of the bar scene at that time. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. How did that, at that time, you knew you were gay. You were experiencing that there was really a bigger gay scene out there than you might have known about at 15. But did you have any clue that the next 25 years of your life were going to be submersed in a gay culture? That your whole professional life was basically going to be encompassed in the gay world?
I might have had an inkling, because at the time I also really wanted to be a filmmaker. And one of the things I wanted to do was to tell our stories. So once I came out, I immediately felt like I belonged somewhere, even if I wasn't necessarily popular. I just felt like I found people that I belonged to. I moved around a lot. I went to 18 different schools by the time I graduated. So I never really laid down roots. My family kind of broke up at a really young age. So I never had a sense of belonging or community. And then I'm mixed race. So I just kind of never felt connected to, like, culturally anywhere either. So when I came out, finding this kind of burgeoning gay community of people who were struggling to fight for rights and for acceptance and to for the right to create their own families and to establish a culture. I felt like I fit right in. I got that, and I wanted to be part of it. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I think it became part of the dream pretty quickly to want to join this movement and to help move it forward in my own way.
So what was your first film project that you were really kind of proud of and thought that you were starting to kind of get that underway and getting that career in the filmmaking world established, where you knew that would be the path for the future?
Mm-hmm. So when I was in college, still not 21 yet, but most of my college, I was under 21. I started making film projects there. I was involved in a public access show that I was a co-creator of and then the director of. And it was a political roundtable show with LGBTQ panelists who just discussed politics. It was called E Queeribus Unum. We had a gay Republican on it. We had a Libertarian. And then we had a Democrat and then a far right or far left total socialist type. And the four of them would just discuss different topics in a very friendly and kind of fun way. And then we would intermix skits, like sketches within that. So, and those ran the gamut. They were just kind of whatever we wanted to do. So maybe we would have someone in drag go into a mall, like a Pottery Barn, to try to buy an urn for her dead boyfriend or something, you know, something like that. And then we'd go and film until we got kicked out. So that was my first truly queer political filmmaking experience. What was this live public access show with kind of pre-taped interstitial segments.
Now you have one project that you're very much connected to that a lot of people will identify your name and your work from Rick and Steve, mm-hmm. which is kind of an amazing project. I'm guessing it was kind of born out of that whole Adult Swim concept and the maturization of cartoons and animated programming in the U.S. Because before that time frame, we really didn't have that. Cartoons were for kids, and then adults watched soap operas or something.
Yeah, I was really into. Well, The Simpsons was a huge influence on that. I made the first episode of Rick and Steve in film school in 1999, and I made it all out of Legos. The assignment was to make a short about relationships, and I liked that we were finally starting to see LGBTQ characters here and there, like Will and Grace had just started. But what really I felt was lacking was any concept of an LGBTQ family or anything where we were dating, where we had, we were either desexualized or whores. Like there was nothing in between. There were no like relationships and families and dating. And I said, what if we just had like something that was like the Brady Bunch, but it was gay. And then I created this short film in film school out of Legos. And that was Rick and Steve, the happiest gay couple in all the world. And it was just like my take on a sitcom if the family at the center of it was totally queer.
Now, with the success of that program, which mm-hmm. I see you're still very proud of, I can see over your shoulder most of the cast sitting on the bookcase there.
Yeah, Steve up there and their neighbors, Dina and Kirsten and Chuck and Evan.
But with the success of that, did you know that you were onto something at that point that, yes, not only can I be a filmmaker, but I can be a gay filmmaker. I can make movies about gay culture and it can be a success. It's not going to be a fringe thing and I'm not going to have to wait tables during the day to make it successful. was that the breaking point? Was when, you know, Rick and Steve kind of came out and you saw the response to that?
I don't know that I've ever had that realization. It's still tough to make LGBTQ projects. It's still tough to get paid for them. It's still tough to tell these stories and then, you know, make enough money to support yourself. So I have not yet had that realization. Hopefully someday I will. No, the projects do not come easily and they do not come well financed.
That's kind of unfortunate.
So yeah, it is.
So Rick and Steve was kind of a novel concept. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, it's animated. It started out with a Lego project for film school.
Yeah.
And then almost diametrically opposed to that, you made a great movie. I loved this movie the first time I saw it. I actually own the DVD and I've watched it many times. Boy Culture, which is totally different. I mean, Rick and Steve is a little bit, I want to say juvenile or lighthearted, very, you know, easygoing, la la la, we're gay, mm-hmm. and rainbows and unicorns everywhere. And then Boy Culture takes a serious look at a guy who makes his living as a male prostitute, basically. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? Was this just something else that was in the back of your head, or, you know, did you work as a male prostitute at one time? I want to tell everybody about it, or how did that evolve?
So A Boy Culture came from a book written by Matthew Rettenmund. It was a best-selling novel, and the producer who had optioned the novel to turn it into a film, I met through Rick and Steve. We met through a mutual friend, and he really responded to my Rick and Steve short, and helped me out a little bit in getting that video to film transfer. And then we just kind of stayed in touch. And then he said, I have this novel that we've optioned, that maybe you could help us out with the screenplay. There were two producers attached. So he introduced me to the other producer who had kind of taken a stab at the screenplay. And then I took a look at it and I really loved the book. I thought it was just hilarious and funny and poignant. And there were just such interesting and astute observations about our community that kind of went beyond the idea of just someone having sex for money. Right. So I loved it right away. I took on the project. I adapted it. I was not attached to direct initially. There was already someone attached to direct. So I did my version of the script and they were happy with it. And the person who was attached fell out. I'm not sure why. I think another project. And so then they offered to attach me. And that's kind of how I became part of Boy Culture. It wasn't really something that I invented or that was, you know, a deep-seated passion. But it was something I responded to so viscerally when I read the book.
And apparently you had such a good connection with Matt and mm-hmm. With the story and everybody else involved that you are currently releasing a series mm-hmm. based on that same storyline with several of the same characters in the series that were in the original movie. And that's going through the film festival circuit right now, as I understand.
Yeah. So the book is a series of confessions by X, this sex worker who kind of takes us through his life through the series of confessions. And I always thought when initially adapting the book that this would make a great TV show, a TV show about a hustler who sees a different client every episode. I just thought that would be so fantastic to watch. So we actually, after the movie first came out in 2006, we started pitching the series right away. But 2006, no one was ready for something so sexual and so gay. They were like, it could be one or the other, but not both.
Right.
So we didn't get too far with that pitch. A few years later, streaming becomes a bit more popular. They're looking for more content. So 2013, it's not really big yet, but we decided let's just start making some episodes on our own and see what we can do. So we wrote, Matthew and I wrote together this series. We co-created it. And we decided to pick up with our main characters 10 years later so we could see, play with themes of age and aging and sex work and our community. And little did we know it'd still be a long road before we even shot it. So it took a while to, we took the script around, tried to raise some money. It was difficult. So we ended up doing a Kickstarter in 2017 to raise a significant portion of the money, but we still had to do some more fundraising. We filmed it in 2018 and still had to do more fundraising for the finishing funds. So that took a while. Then COVID came around and kind of delayed it a little bit more. But now in 2021, finally, we are screening this project that was written 7 years after the film, takes place 10 years after the film, but in reality, it's 15 years after the film.
Yeah, I'm kind of, I haven't seen it yet. I know it's streaming. Sometimes when some of the film festivals are showing it, they're also making it available online. I just have to make time to be somewhere where I can watch it at that point. But I'm really looking forward to it. And I see now in the new story, in the series, you've brought in a new character that is portrayed by Jason Caceres. And who is kind of a younger, sexy new ex who's teaching the old ex how to adapt to the changes in gay culture in this time frame that's passed since then. How did you stumble across Jason? How did he get into that?
He just auditioned. I'm not sure how he came to us, but we were casting that part for quite a while. It was really hard to find someone who had the right energy, who could be bossy and sexy and funny and at times overbearing, but still just kind of lovable. There were so many things that this character needed, and people were bringing us lots of elements, but not all of them. And then Jason came in and he just knocked it out of the park right away. He just absolutely fit who Chase was. He got it. He took the role and ran with it. And then he brought so much of his own energy and flavor to the role, stuff that I, hadn't even thought of in writing it. So I felt very lucky to have met Jason through this process.
Yeah, he's a great actor and he's done a lot of cool roles. And I even, when I'm going through my Facebook feed and I constantly see these pictures, he's probably got the world's largest collection of black lace shirts.
Oh yeah.
Anyone in the world. I think he likes showing off that, toned body and having that sexy yet, I'm not going to show too much here. I'm going to tease you. But so that sounds like a really great project. And I'm really kind of looking forward to finding out how, what the transition is between the original boy culture and the new one. Now,
in short, it's about X and Andrew, the main couple who meet
right in
the film. We pick up with them 10 years later. They've moved to L.A. X has fallen out of the sex work, but their relationship has kind of crumbled and they've decided to break up and they're living together in the same house that they bought. They bought a house together. So they're living together broken up is where we pick up. And we navigate this relationship as it, continues to fall apart, and X as he dips his toes back into an industry that he's been away from for 10 years, only to find that things have completely changed. And he's, whereas once he was like this, this escort who didn't have to do any advertising, who could charge a lot of money, to somebody who is just kind of one in a million. And has to try to stand out to be able to charge anything.
A lot of things in the gay world have changed in the last 10 or 20 years. And
yeah,
so I'm looking forward to seeing how you've represented that. So when we were talking previously about some of the different gay bars from the past that have had an impact on you and the path that your life has taken, you mentioned another one in Seattle, which was the Timberline.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume the Timberline came after your initial experience with Neighbors. It was maybe a little bit later into the 90s.
It was after I turned 21 that I could start going. So the Timberline was a country western gay club in Seattle. But on Sundays, they had a disco tea. And I would go there. And it was just a very different vibe, a very different feel. And it felt like seeing kind of another aspect of our community where we just would come together just to dance and, I don't know, have a beer bust and let your hair down, maybe do some line dancing just before or after, because they would kind of intersperse a few line dance songs with the disco. So I really enjoyed that, so much so that we ended up shooting Boy Culture. There's a bar called Boy Culture in the film Boy Culture, but it's actually the Timberline with the sign Boy Culture hanging over the door.
Oh, okay. Very cool. I did not know that.
So yeah, that is why that's why I listed that as having an impact on me and my life's path. I just really enjoyed going there.
So they kind of had
and shooting there as well.
So they kind of had this disco line dancing option on Sundays.
Right. Yeah. It was like their it's called the tea dance on Sundays.
So you had to wear like what, rhinestone cowboy boots or something?
No, it was whatever you wanted. It wasn't really, so they were a country western bar except for that afternoon. They would still do a couple of numbers so that the regulars could, you know, do some line dancing, and then those of us who just visited on the Sundays could kind of get a taste of the culture of the rest of the bar and participate a little and maybe be drawn to coming on another night. I think it was a brilliant, brilliant idea.
Was it like so many of the bars back then, the decor and the vibe of the bar almost had their own individual flavor. I mean, if somebody had blindfolded you and put you in the middle of a club and then let you look at it, you'd almost know, even without customers being there, what their focus was. Was this one of those country western clubs that tried to put like a split rail fence around and hang some western stuff on the wall? Or was it just that it happened to be focused more on, you know, Levi leather jeans kind of guys that came in during the week?
I think a little bit of both. So the original location was this giant lodge. It was like an Elks Lodge. So it already had that kind of feel, that kind of country feel, just space. The second location, it closed down and then moved to a second location later in the late 90s, early 2000s. That location didn't have as much of that vibe. It felt more like a standard club that just kind of had different, you know, it felt a lot more standard. It didn't have that kind of Elks Lodge feel. And that's where we ended up shooting the movie, in that second location that they moved to.
Oh, very cool. I'll have to watch the movie again and look for it.
Yeah, you wouldn't, there's nothing country at all in the, it plays a different bar. So the type of bar that Boy Culture is really more like a Neighbors, where it's just kind of the standard city gay bar, like the one that you go to when you first go to a city, every city seems to have one. Like this is like here it was Rage, I think, in West Hollywood, but now it's the Abbey, I think, is kind of, it's just the place you go. If you're going to go to one place, you go visit this place because that's going to be the most crowded.
Now, so far, all the bars that we've talked about have been in Seattle, which obviously was where you spent your teen years, late teens, early 20s.
Right.
And then you mentioned a bar from Frankfurt, Germany, called the Blue Angel. How did you end up in Frankfurt?
So I went back to Frankfurt in my summers in college. I went back. I had some exchange student friends from high school that I went to visit. And there was this little dive bar called the Blue Angel that was just so fun. I would go twice, like both nights of the week there and just dance. I liked the music. It was so divey and so intimate. I didn't understand anybody ever, hardly. A fun, I don't know. I just have really, really fun memories of that. And then, you know, it closed down. And after I stopped going, you know, it closed down. I found out, I looked it up a few years ago just to see what became of it. And it's no longer there.
And you mentioned it wasn't much, you know, much to talk about. It wasn't a big, grand, fabulous bar or anything. But I did find something about it online that somebody had a vintage T-shirt or something from there. And they labeled themselves as a bar discotheque.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a disco. There was a dance floor. It just wasn't very big. Right. You know, maybe 20 people could fit on the dance floor. It wasn't a tiny little... It wasn't a tiny little dive.
Right, it wasn't three bar stools and a counter.
Yeah, it was medium size, and it was so dark. It's probably the darkest club I've ever been to. Like it's so hard to see there. And then there were mirrors on a lot of walls to kind of make the space feel bigger. It was more about just my time there, and I think maybe also, you know, being an American in Germany. Being a gay, you know, a gay, oh yeah. And I wasn't 21 yet. So I actually, that would be my first, no, cause I already had gone to neighbors I went to under 21. So that was the other thing too. I couldn't go out in my first years of college here in Seattle. So if I went to, Germany, I could go out dancing. You know, there was no 21 limit. So there I could feel connected to the community in a way that I couldn't feel that in Seattle.
Yeah, and it also, I guess, gave you an insight into a little bit broader spectrum of the gay community, because you were also in a foreign place. So mm-hmm. you were seeing that it wasn't just an anomaly of, oh, well, there's this one funky little bar that I can go to in Seattle, but I can go all the way, you know, halfway across the world and I can find another one that I can fit into. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would travel around Europe those summers and, you know, there was no internet really back then. So you couldn't really look things up or
connect. Right.
But there was this book called the Gay Dameron Guide. And I would get that, and it was like a phone book of just gay spaces. So I would get that and look for clubs. And that's actually how I found the Blue Angel. It was in that guide because I was in Frankfurt and I just fell in love with that place.
And your friends there weren't gay? They were just classmates or?
One was and one wasn't.
So in addition to that, you've mentioned another bar that played a role in your, in the formulation of your character and your life's path in LA, which was called The Factory. And mm-hmm. that's almost diametrically opposed to something like the Blue Angel. I mean, The Factory was a huge prefabricated building mm-hmm. that had been around since the 30s in Los Angeles and been through several incarnations. I'm guessing, based on your age, that you were there after it was Studio One. And went back to being correct. The factory again.
Yes.
Originally it was a film factory where they made some kind of film for the movie industry. And then it went through a couple of iterations. It became a bar called The Factory. Mm-hmm. Then it became a very well-known bar called Studio One. Mm-hmm. And then it went back to being called The Factory. And that would have been what, the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, it was the... late 99 and 2000 was my first time there. Yeah, it is exactly that. It was kind of like my earlier story with the Oz and its previous name. Right. I only knew it as the factory, but people there would be like, oh, this used to be Studio One. And I was like, oh, that's before my era. I don't know what you're talking about. Kind of a bit similar feel. But yeah, it was gigantic. It was, Neighbors is pretty large, so I'd seen some, you know, something of size, but what I hadn't seen was LA Boys, and just how there are so many beautiful people here. It's like an insanely odd concentration of like physically beautiful people. I think largely because the industry, the film industry, attracts like every good looking person from every town to come and try to
right.
While it's, you know, really enjoyable to look at, it also can kind of mess up with your own self image, your own self image. So it's kind of this double-edged sword. And that was a whole new adventure for me, seeing that so intensely in the factory. But at the end of the day, what I really enjoyed was I just loved dancing to good pop music. And that's what they had. That's what they specialized in, pop music and, you know, a pretty healthy sized dance floor.
And you'll be happy to know, if you don't already know this, that the factory building was actually recently disassembled. It was a prefabricated building, which was, you know, basically shipped on, I guess, truck beds and assembled on site. And after all these years, they decided it was of some historical significance. So they deconstructed it, took all the rivets out and unbolted it and packed it up, numbered it and packed it up. And it's supposedly going to be preserved as a historic landmark and reconstructed somewhere in the general vicinity of where it was. There's apparently some complex there, industrial complex, where they're going to reassemble the building. So the building will still be in existence, even though not at that street address.
Huh, where is it? Will it still be in West Hollywood? Or will it be like out in the valley?
I understood it wasn't going to be far from where it is, where it was. So I guess we'll find out as they actually...
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of empty space in West Hollywood for them to put it up.
Who knows?
Interesting.
So
it may live on.
It may. So was boy culture in any way a part of the concept of doing such an outrageously gay series of movies called Eating Out? Did the exposure to all those beautiful guys with their shirts off, dancing around, and gay people everywhere, did that somehow impact your concept of creating the Eating Out movie?
Well, not really. So Eating Out came before Boy Culture. Eating Out was my first feature film. And Eating Out really came from my obsession with like college sex comedies, I call them. Okay. In the 80s, I loved Porky's and Meatballs, and the 90s American Pie,
right?
Revenge of the Nerds. I like these movies where it was all about people who just desperately wanted to get laid. In fact, that was the plot: is how does this person get laid? But there was never any representation of us. Like, there were never LGBTQ people, and if they were, they were definitely not getting laid. They were either getting beat up or made fun of,
right?
That would be it. So I always wanted an American Pie for us. And that's where Eating Out came from. I wrote it in film school here as a joke, actually. I didn't think I was ever going to make it because it was too raunchy, I thought. But I thought it would be really fun. So I was in screenwriting class at film school, and we would have to write pages every week and bring them in and read them in class. And I thought it would be fun to do something really, really queer and really raunchy with full on sex. And I don't know if you've seen the first Eating Out movie, but there's
this I have.
17 minute phone sex scene.
Yes.
And that was written just to read in class. That's where the whole thing came from. And the class dug it, you know. So I kept writing. I wrote the full screenplay there. And then afterwards, I didn't think I'd ever make it. I had all these other things that I felt were more important, like dramas or, I don't know, things that were emotional and life-changing for me. And then I thought my comedy bit was going to be the Rick and Steve show that I kind of made in school as well. But, I couldn't get any of my other more serious films off the ground. And then I met this producer, Michael Scholl, who loved Rick and Steve and kind of specialized in distributing LGBTQ films to video stores. He was a distributor who wanted to produce something original. And he said that he had $43,000 to invest. If he made a film that didn't go over that budget, he could distribute it to enough stores as long as it wasn't really bad and had two full frontal nudity shots in it. He would be able to get enough distribution that we would make $60,000 back from the initial investment. So he's like, do you have any script that can be shot for that budget? And I said, well, I have this one that was kind of a joke, and there could definitely be full frontal nudity in it. So I gave him Eating Out, and he loved it, and we went off and shot it. And I honestly never would have imagined it to have the response that it did. I don't think it's the best made film. I don't think it's the best written film, but it was everything that I wanted at the time, which was, you know, an American Pie for us, Porky's for us. And there was a community who wanted something like that. I didn't realize how much of a response it would get. Ultimately that first film grossed 2 million in DVD sales. It was like the number one selling LGBT DVD for years, and played hundreds of film festivals, won a bunch of prizes. I never would have imagined that. Let alone I wouldn't have thought that there would be four sequels to that film. But there are so many stories to tell, so many adventures. Like in 4 and 5, we want to bring in trans characters and lesbian characters. I still think there's so many more Eating Out stories to tell, because sex is fun and funny, and we don't talk about it enough. And so the Eating Out films have a really special place in my heart. I didn't realize they were my voice until I started making them. It was kind of just an unexpected surprise.
And the thing about Eating Out, I remember when I first saw it, and of course, having come out in the late 70s and pretty much living a gay lifestyle from mm-hmm. then on, I was aware of what was out there as far as movies and entertainment. And I remember when the first, when La Casa au Fall first came out, mm-hmm. and how enthusiastic people were about it, how exciting it was to have, mm-hmm. A movie that was fun and entertaining and colorful and had an interesting blend of characters, but that was all about gay. In some way or other. And I remember thinking the same thing when the first Eating Out came out. It wasn't just, a handful of cute college guys in a bar trying to pick each other up. Mm-hmm. There were, straight girls who were turned on by gay sex. There was a straight guy who wanted to pretend he was gay so he could get a girl. There was mm-hmm. like all kinds of different aspects and dimensions to the movie that mm-hmm. it was really kind of, very heartwarming to be able to see that in a film back then, mm-hmm. and know that that we were starting to be represented a little bit more in something other than a casual character on Dynasty. Oh, well, one character's gay. Okay.
Right.
It was really kind of the start of seeing fully evolved projects that were the focal point was gay somehow, mm-hmm. And so although I cannot say that at that time I thought there would be four more of them, I'm not really surprised. Uh-huh. And it's certainly something that, you know, you should be proud of, because obviously you're one of the people that kind of broke that barrier and said, hey, you know, we're going to do this. And we made it successful and now paved the way for so many more that have come out since then. I mean, there are so many TV shows and movies and whatever that have included gay culture as a very significant component of them. And you should be very proud of that accomplishment. I mean, that's a big deal.
Thanks. Thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, there were a lot more people before me who had it a lot harder. So I, you know, there are so many more other people on it, including John Waters, who's such a huge,
yes.
His work for me, like, just completely opened up the idea of what a film could be. So I wanted to be a filmmaker early on before I really even knew what I wanted to make films about. And it was John Waters who, seeing Desperate Living and Pink Flamingos back to back, that made me realize that films could be about anything, like literally anything, even me. Before that, I thought I was going to be telling other people's stories, that, you know, you go to Hollywood and you try to make a romance or a comedy and tell other people's stories. It was John Waters who was out there being himself, like when nobody wanted to see anything like that. And that, like, yeah, he inspired me to make these films about whatever I want and to make them about myself. And because of that, Ming Stoll is in four of these Eating Out films because of my gratitude towards John Waters.
And you've had some other iconic, gay characters in there. I think Leslie Jordan was in mm-hmm. at least one of them.
Yeah, he's in the third one.
Yeah. What a great character he plays too. I mean, what I almost hesitate to say it's a character, because I've met Leslie. I've spent time with him. I've had dinner with him. And that's pretty much Leslie. I mean, he's, yeah. You know, 24/7, he's on.
Like, generous and funny and loving and loves this community.
He does.
Yeah.
So you've done all these projects that were focused on the gay culture in some way or another, mm-hmm. From different perspectives. And then I think is your most recent project Before I Got Famous.
Mm-hmm.
And that has nothing.
I guess that's most recent, but Boy Culture would be.
Well, yeah, the Boy Culture series, but Before I Got Famous has nothing gay in it, does it?
No, it's gay. The lead character is gay. It is about a gay kid in China who he's growing up. Everyone tells him he is gorgeous and should become an actor.
Right.
So he comes to LA to become an actor, and he's hot. He's like a literally hot guy, only to find out that people have really narrow standards of beauty here and think of him as just some ugly Asian guy. He's only offered like terrible typecasted roles. And then also he starts to come to terms with the gay self here. He's not out to his parents. Over the course of the series, he meets a bartender who's also an immigrant, and they form a friendship that eventually becomes a really romantic connection.
Yeah, and I don't know why I was thinking it wasn't gay, because I watched it and mm-hmm. I knew that that's why he came over here. And I know the bartender's Latino, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I knew that. I don't know why I was thinking it wasn't. I guess just because my brain's on vacation or something. So now you yourself have some Asian heritage as well, correct?
Yeah, Filipino.
So was that an influence in doing the Before I Got Famous series? Did you want to have an Asian character? Because in, you know, most of the other movies, there's really not a predominantly, you know, really important character in the show that's Asian in Boy Reading Out. Yeah, Rick is
Filipino. Yeah, I always want to include Asians characters as much as possible. The first Eating Out movie we cast, the casting description was just like open ethnicity. And, you know, there just weren't many people at the time, people of color auditioning for LGBTQ roles. It was very, very few. I don't think there were very few gay people auditioning. It was hard to find, it was just really hard to cast. And I ended up with an all-white cast. And I didn't enjoy the feeling that I felt after that, just being part of not being able to represent my own self on screen. So after that, I said, I want to make sure that my future work has people of color in it. And so Boy Culture, the book is actually all, the characters are all white. And when I adapted it, I made a strong case for why it was important for me, for my films going forward, to have, you know, people of color in lead roles. That is how Andrew came from a white character to a black character in Boy Culture. I've just continued to do that, every opportunity I get. So here I had an opportunity to have a lead who was Asian, and the whole series is built around him and his family. It was wonderful. I did not direct the series, though. I just wrote and co-created it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I really enjoyed watching it. I didn't know what to expect. I had never heard of it before. You know, I started doing some research on some of your work. Most everything else I had seen before, Boy Culture, Rick and Steve, Eating Out. But before I got famous, I wasn't really familiar with it. So I made a point to watch about, I think, 7 or 8 episodes, just to kind of get a feel for it. And apparently somehow in the translation, I forgot that the main character was gay, which is the whole point of the show. So maybe I need to go back and watch it again. So your early bar experiences, when you were starting some of these projects and you were in college, you were in Seattle. Obviously you moved to LA. Are you still in LA now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's where you encountered your experience with Rage also, which was another bar that, if I'm not mistaken, was open for quite a while, 30 years or more, mm-hmm. and just recently closed, like within the COVID.
Yeah, during the pandemic.
And is that not the space that is supposedly going to be redeveloped and reopened by Lance Bass? I've heard rumors.
Sure. I actually don't live in West Hollywood anymore. I live near Northridge. I used to live like a block away from Rage. So I was really familiar with everything around there until 4 years ago I moved away.
Well, from what I remember, Lance Bass has taken over the old Rage spot, and they're in the process of converting it into an even more fabulous and memorable gay bar that supposedly is going to rock the world. So I don't know what he's putting in there or what he's doing or when it's opening, but supposedly there's something fabulous coming to that old Rage location. So you can go there and
live
some of your memories.
That opens, I'll definitely go.
So I've talked to other people who have been involved in the entertainment industry and have had, you know, bars impact their careers and kind of formulate who they became or what their vision of the gay community was. And obviously you've lived through it for a couple of decades and experienced a lot of things in the club scene. Part of the reason I wanted to kind of do this project is because a lot of these stories, you know, as with many stories, you know, from even when you were a teenager, they're not really preserved. You don't know what happened 10, 20, 30 years before you entered the bar scene because nobody cared enough to record it. Mm-hmm. And you've been doing a great job kind of capturing a lot of gay culture in your movies. But my goal was just kind of keep the stories out there, to find a way to put them out there where people can find them and hear about them from, you know, firsthand from people who experience them and know that the gay bar scene has an interesting and storied history, that a lot of things have happened as a result of the gay bars, and that they have impacted a lot of people's lives in a lot of different ways. Now, are you still working on Before I Got Famous, or is that series done?
I think it's done. I don't think they have the money to make more.
So what is next?
I have a couple of projects that I'm trying to get funded. So nothing official. Hopefully one of them comes through. The immediate future right now is promoting boy culture and hopefully finding a home for it that would like to make more episodes.
That would be incredible. And now we do have a couple of outlets that we didn't have before. I know one of the ones that people are talking about a lot is Reverie, mm-hmm. which I believe is where Before I Got Famous is.
Yeah, that's where.
I think that's where I saw it. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's the only place you can watch it.
Well, then obviously that's where I saw it. And that's kind of cool too, because, you know, without all this content out there, without people like you creating this content, there would be no way to make that kind of a streaming service if there was no content to put on it. And there's quite a bit of content on there. So maybe, you know, maybe Damien will look at it and say, hey, you know,
He did buy it, you know. So we made Before I Got Famous independently, you know, and they bought it, but I think the budgets just don't work for another season.
But I'm saying, like with, you know, the Boy Culture series or any other projects, you know, there are now places there that are
right.
genuinely gay, that are not, you know, just waving the flag and saying, well, we're going to show some gay stuff here. Mm-hmm. So, I really hope that works out for you, because I would love to see some more kind of fun stuff that looks at our culture from people who know what it's about. It's not a, you know, Steven Spielberg making a movie about what he thinks gay culture is like, but it's somebody who's lived through it, who's experienced it, who's been impacted by it, mm-hmm. and is out there telling their stories. So I really appreciate what you do. And I look forward to whatever it is that you bring up next. Whatever you come up with that will kind of feature our community down the road.
Thank you, Arjen. Thank you so much for doing this. I think this is a really important project. And yeah, like bars all over the world are closing. Like there are like 7 or 8 lesbian bars left.
I mean, there's only a handful of lesbian bars in the country.
Yeah. So you know, there may be a time when there are no gay bars left either. So it is important part of our history, and maybe it'll be a good reason. Maybe in the future we won't need them at all, but it's still a huge part of our history, and it's so good that you are making a record of that.
Oh, thank you. And it's with the help of people like you that it can be done. I can't tell all the stories on my own. I haven't been to all these bars, but getting a little bit from a bunch of people makes it all that much more interesting, and it of course teaches me and everybody who watches it a little bit more about our history. So thank you. And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.